Today on the Potential Psychology Podcast.
I think that we have to say the future of work is going to be mixed. We're going to have all of this
stuff. There's no one size fits all.
There's no one size fits all. But what I would say is that we do need to be active as individuals in a society to looking at what do we want for our children, what policies, what labor laws and so forth. We need to be engaged in that conversation because otherwise you will get an environment where your kids have to work two, maybe even three jobs just to pay the rent. So there are real concerns around that. Good news is we have a democracy. Use it.
Welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, psychologist Ellen Jackson, and this is the show in which we explore what it is to be human and how we as humans can fulfill our potential. Welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I am here with my co-host for this season, Dr. Joe Sweeney. And
hi.
We are talking, hi, we are talking about how to prepare our children for the future of work. This is the series of conversations that we're having for this season of the show. And in our last episode, Joe, we got into, I suppose, the parental role, perhaps, in all of this. We talked about, so you've done a wealth of research that sits behind our conversations today, asking parents, both through survey data, but also got some great kind of key questions that have come out, asking parents about what they think, feel, expect, perhaps need to know about the future of work for their children. But of course, that applies just as much to the parents themselves. And, you know, you've done some great analysis around all of this data that we've been able to kind of unpick and explore. So last episode, by the time this goes to air, it was the parents' role. So a bit about the education and even, you know, what we can do as parents with kids perhaps at school now to start developing what they need to be able to thrive into the future. And we're going to go a little further into the skills of that today. Would that be fair?
Yes. Yeah. I would really like to dive into some of those because I think, you know, when we talk about the future of work, we have to think about what's needed for the future of work, let alone what it looks like, you know, what's going to be needed given the fact that we're not really too sure about what that future looks like.
Yeah. And one of the questions that came through from listeners, so we did a little, and some of our listeners would have responded to these surveys because we put it out on our social channels, was, will my kids have the same secure work experience that I had, or will life be constantly adapting, changing jobs, scrambling to find employment? So a lot of uncertainty in there that probably speaks as much to the future of work in a technological sense as in an economic, political, and a number of other factors as well. What are your thoughts on what we know about this?
Well, for me, that's actually one of the things which scares me the most. You know, what does that future work look like? Because up until COVID, we were heading very much towards this idea of an increasingly gig economy where everyone would have a side hustle and you'd have three or four jobs. I've sometimes called it at some conferences the Americanization of employment, because if we take a look at, for example, America, you've got a big portion of the population there who are working multiple jobs. And they have to, because the economic structures are such that that's required. We don't get that in Europe. We don't get that in Australia and a few other places because there are, you know, there's a whole raft of legislation, fair work legislation, and so forth. So the connection with this is that you can't separate the future of work from government policy, from economic situations, but also how we educate our population, how we educate students, feeds into that discussion as well. So all of that's to say, this is a really complex issue, and I don't think anyone really has the answer. I was a participant in a future of work think tank some years ago, about a year before COVID, and it was really interesting. We had a representative from India there, and I'm quite negative gig economy. I think it strips away a lot of necessary rights for employees. His comment was, this is the best thing ever, because in India we have many, many people who are under or just not employed, and the gig economy gives them access to employment that they wouldn't otherwise have. And I went, huh, yeah, you know, you can't, it's not one blanket statement.
Yeah, it doesn't sit in there.
And our Singaporean representative was absolutely not. This is the worst thing that can possibly happen because it just totally destroys all professionalism.
Okay, so there's kind of a socio-political context that sits around this as to whether or not it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Exactly. So, you know, I learned from that to be a little bit more careful and a little bit nuanced in my discussion around this. But we did ask the respondents to our study, it's about 390 people. We were asking people, what do we think the future of work, what underpins the future of work, the imperative, if you will. And the number one outcome was society comes first. When society thrives, businesses prosper. In other words, this notion that we are seeing a lot of talk about since COVID, which is corporations having a social responsibility sort of objective.
One of my favorite
And those are getting
topics.
Measured. it's a really interesting one. And interestingly, by the way, kids are really adept at cutting through the crap and seeing the companies that are just, you know, sticking a freedom or a LGBT or whatever logo on.
It can't just be spin.
Versus the ones that are actually doing stuff, that are really sticking to the morals that they state. But what was interesting is we had other comments such as innovation rules, innovation outpaces regulations. So we're going to continue to see governments struggling to figure out what to do about the future of work. Social responsibility, trust and care dominate the corporate agenda, very, very highly rated. And then the other end of the spectrum, we had gig work becomes the new normal. But the difference statistically, the number of people who are reporting those things was minimal. So okay. We have this huge spread. There is no agreement. There is no consistency. And I think at the heart of it, that might be why we have so much fear. I think I mentioned it was about, 79% of people are saying that they were, forget the exact percentage, were saying that they're worried about the future of work. Well, this is why, because we don't know what it looks like.
We don't know what it looks like. And that's before we even get into the kind of the technological piece and jobs and roles and things. So there's this, just so that I'm really clear, so we're talking here about having almost like this broad overlay piece of what's the essence of work. And I can only assume that COVID is really possibly in good ways and in contributing to this uncertainty. I know it's certainly been a period of significant reflection for a lot of people around work and career at an individual level. You know, they've been talking in the States about the Great Resignation, and now there's all sorts of people coming up with, say, is it that, you know, what we call the
Quiet quitting,
yes.
which I call as working to rule. I mean, we've had that for a while.
Yeah. So, you know, there's clearly a lot of conversation, and even just, you know, I know in my own coaching work, the number of people that I've spoken to who have had, and I myself, you know, what I call my COVID reflection around, am I doing what I ought to be doing? Am I doing what is sustainable for me, both in terms of purpose and meaning, but also in terms of lifestyle and my other commitments that I have. So there's been that sort of reflection, but maybe also this stepping back and looking at what is the nature of work, what should it be? And the fact that we've got this incredible spread of people who are saying, you know, some people saying that, you know, work and organizations and workplaces need to have a bigger part in what our society is and make a bigger, more meaningful contribution through to people who feel like the Ubers and other kind of gig type work of the world will be what dominates, just is part of this kind of mixed up, messed up. We're reflecting, we don't know where we're at.
Yeah. And I think we have, in putting nuance on that, we have to understand that many people, many of our listeners, us certainly, are actually very privileged.
Oh, of course.
You know, I've worked with myself, I've run businesses myself for most of my career. I recognized very early on I didn't really fit the corporate lifestyle. So, you know, and I've been fortunate that I was at an age where I could build that type of new environment that I wanted. Not everyone has that. My daughter absolutely has that. She chose the company she wanted to work for. They're a games company that does health games to promote health. And, you know, she got the job by drawing fan art. Then they hired her as a gig worker, and then now she's the art director.
There's that thing we were talking about in our last episode about kids following their passions.
Following the passions. And yet, you know, my son, much better off sitting in a, you know, more of that office environment. And then I've spoken with people who are gig workers and they love it because it gives them the freedom to work where they want. So I think we need to be careful. And I think the spread of results of different opinions about what the future work really reflects the fact that I think that we had to say the future of work is going to be mixed. We're going to have all of this
stuff. There's no one size fits all.
There's no one size fits all. But what I would say is that we do need to be active as individuals in a society to looking at what do we want for our children, what policies, what labor laws and so forth. We need to be engaged in that conversation, because otherwise you will get an environment where your kids have to work two, maybe even three jobs just to pay the rent. So there are real concerns around that. Good news is we have a democracy. Use it.
So get involved and make decisions. And yeah, I guess that's something I hadn't really reflected. I think so often when we talk about the future of work, and certainly the general commentary that you might see in the media, it is dominated by perhaps technology. The imagination runs wild about, you know, what robots are going to be doing. And I know we'll have that conversation a little further down the track. But to start thinking about it in terms of, yeah, labor laws and socioeconomic factors that will come into play, those things that then intersect with some of the other challenges we're facing around housing and housing affordability. And where, if we come back to our conversation, for those who listened to our first episode, and if you haven't, please do, because it'll give you some context, this pathways notion, or the pathways and agency, the will and the way, you know, the hope. So, you know, part of this perhaps, Joe, you're suggesting is, you know, get involved in, if it's your local, you know, political situation, or just understand that you have a part to play in helping to dictate some of those issues. Absolutely. Those legislative, political, social.
Be informed and vote by policy. You know, become a swing voter. Okay, now that's a little bit of a political stance here, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There is an intent that we as the public can place on the future of work. This is not total random. The other interesting part, so there will be people on this podcast, I'm sure, who are involved in large corporations or even mid-sized corporations who are looking to try and figure out what their role is and what their hiring is going to be. And often a lot of that comes down to, we want staff retention, we want the best staff and so forth. And what we do know from many, many, many studies is that people don't work anymore, and I think COVID certainly accelerated this, they don't work at a company just for the paycheck.
Yeah.
They certainly don't put in that extra, you know,
discretionary.
They will engage in quiet quitting, as it's well.
Yeah.
You know, if there's not a purpose. So what is the purpose? What's the, you know, and then live that purpose and have everyone live towards it. And we know that the most highly productive and in many cases actually economically viable companies have a strong purpose.
There's a wonderful book that I'm reading at the moment by B. Boccalandro, and I'm going to have to really quickly Google the exact title, because when I say I'm reading it, I'm actually listening to it on an audio book, because that's quite
often how I do that too. Audio books
fit in all the reading. How on earth do you fit in all the reading if you don't listen while you're doing other things?
Audio books are the bomb.
They are. And so B. Boccalandro is a American researcher, and she talks about job purposing, which is an intersection really of part of what you're just talking about there, the role that corporates have in helping to articulate what it is their purpose is beyond the traditional profit motive. So again, this kind of move away perhaps from what workplaces were, not all of them, obviously. I mean, social enterprise and social purpose has been existent, particularly in the not-for-profit sector, for forever. But in perhaps a broader remit of workplaces, now starting to look at what purpose those organizations play.
And the irony here is that the birth of the corporation, of the legal entity called the corporation, actually came from having a social purpose that could not be achieved by the government alone. And so we're sort of coming all the way back, all the way back.
Yeah.
And I suspect that's also because we are entering an era of incredible change and incredible challenges. I mentioned global warming and climate change, but we also have unrest, we have growing populations, we have food issues. We have all the technology, I really believe, and I think that's, again, the optimist nature, you know, the required optimist nature. We have the technologies and the capability to solve many of these issues. What we need is the structures and the will to do that. And I think I mentioned in the previous episode, the future of work, the opportunities for the new jobs will actually occur in those areas. We know that. And so when I'm, you know, if I was saying to a corporation, know what you're trying to achieve, articulate it really, really well, you'll get the right people who are, you know, involved in that. And in some ways, I suspect for a lot of people, the split between, you know, we talk about this work-life balance, really important, really, really important. But when those things are aligned, the purpose of your job and the purpose of your life, how you see yourself, are well aligned in a healthy way, that's when magic really happens. That's when you get happy workers and great productivity and society benefits.
And I finally finished my Google search here and found the title. So Bill Gandra's book is Do Good at Work, How Simple Acts of Social Purpose Drive Success and Wellbeing. So it's exactly that, this notion of job purposing for both organizations to be able to articulate, to attract and retain and engage. But at the individual level, how do we... And it very much intersects with the notion of job crafting, which is a big topic in positive organizational scholarship, is, you know, how do I craft my job in even the smallest way to be able to maximize my purpose in life? And it's a wonderful book. It's filled with so many examples of how this is being done through all of the conversations that she's had, particularly with American organizations. It's excellent.
That notion of job crafting sounds like something we should actually be teaching to upper, you know, school students.
Yes. One word answer, yes. Yes, everyone. We should be teaching. I talk about it quite often in the work that I do with organizations and with coaching clients, because it is very much around understanding who am I. And we can come at it from a number of different perspectives. You can come at it from a strengths perspective. So who am I as an individual? What are my strengths? How do I craft my role so that I get to do more of what lights me up? Mm. In the context, you know, you never get 100%, because there's always going to be an element of jobs that require you to do the stuff that really doesn't light you up, but it still has to be done. But if you can do more of what really plays to your strength. So if I'm a people person, then how do I make sure that I'm engaging with people? If I have a strength of love and kindness, for example, which is not something we talk about often in the context of a workplace, if I have that strength, and, you know, how does that play out for me? Do I need to be ensuring that I'm doing, you know, the maximum amount of mentoring or the maximum amount of client assistant work or supporting my colleagues in various tasks so that I get to be the best version of myself, because that contributes to not only my engagement and that sense of flow at work, which is contributing to well-being, but also therefore just your mental health and general happiness and all the other positive things that come from that.
And what's interesting about this is we asked a question in our study about what do you think is the most important thing for your children in the future of their work? What will drive them? It's almost the opposite of that. Our parents are actually thinking the opposite. Now, bear in mind, again, the difference of opinion was a very, very narrow band, but maximizing income was the second It was the most interesting thing.
That is fascinating.
And that's not actually what makes your kids happy.
No, it's not what makes people happy. Yeah, we know that from all the happiness work that's been done. Up to a point, we need to have an income level. And it probably goes back a little to that piece around privilege that you're talking about before. Once we've got to, and the research that was done years ago now in America said $70,000 as an annual salary. That was US dollars, but that was in American context, and it was some time ago. The finding was that beyond that, an increase in income didn't have a commensurate increase in our level of our sense of personal well-being.
There's also some fascinating research, I think it was out of MIT, about motivation. And there's a great little RSA animation of the particular speech.
I know this one. This is TED.
It's a TED Talk.
This is the TED Talk by Dan Pink from his book Drive, which
that's
is
the one.
Underpinned by self-determination theory, which is a whole other conversation we can
But I've actually taken that to heart, because when I've run software teams, I've run teams all over the world, software engineering teams, quite innovative, you know, experimental groups and so forth. None of these people, you cannot afford to keep the best people on the salary which they could get if they walked out the door. There's always another job offer for the best people. So what does it take to keep them? And as a selfless manager, I was always looking for that. The next level up is, you know, what are those intangible rewards? And it's usually around the things that switches them on. For one of my staff, I would send once every month and a half, 2 months, to a beach to sit and drink and scuba dive. And he liked that not because, you know, it was a paid perk. He liked it because his boss knew what he liked. it was a recognition. I had another guy who really just wanted a Lycee packet, a little red envelope every so often saying, you know, job well done, you've completed this here. And then I had another person who just really liked having time off, and you probably know who I'm talking about, time off to go and do things with the Red Cross and so forth, and us contributing to that. But the next level up, and the one that overrides all of that, was mastery. And I hadn't ever called it mastery. I'd always called it learning or career development. And for me, the best way of keeping someone is constantly train them, constantly give them opportunities for learning new things. Oh, gosh, doesn't this look like our discussion around education? Constantly learning new things. They become more valuable to the organization, but they also see a value in themselves. Mm. And the risk that I do hear some HR professionals even still saying is, but if we train them, what happens if they go to our competitor? And my response is, if we don't train them and they stay with us, what happens to us?
If we don't train them, they'll probably leave anyway, because that's what we need. Yeah. That's learning and growth. And yeah, look, absolutely. All the research around thriving at work focuses on this need for growth, mastery, competence, feeling like we are growing as human beings, feeling that we are learning things, feeling that we are increasing our competence in what we do. We're driven as a species by the need to grow and develop. Obviously, not all of us all the time. Sometimes we just want to rest. But that's a generally
well, actually, that was really interesting, because, you know, coming back to the heart of what we were, you know, we started talking about, was what are the skills needed? And one of the things which we have determined from other studies is the skills needed for all of these jobs of the future, for all of these jobs, are actually fairly similar. There is no job in the future that will not, and there are jobs which are going to be automated, so let's discount them for the moment, but all of these other jobs of the future, the skill sets are actually fairly consistent.
Oh, okay. And so what are our top skills, Joe, that we need then, if we're thinking about what we need to do to help cultivate in our children the right skills for prosperity in the future?
So I'm going to reflect back what parents were saying to us, and then we can have a bit of a discussion about what the other research says. Right. But the number one was communicating effectively. And I think that is probably very true. The ability to now communicate is not just transferring information. It's the whole gamut of motivating and all these things that we've been talking about before. How do you work in a team? How do you lead? How do you be a good follower? Because not everyone's going to be a leader. Being a great follower is probably more important in some ways for many jobs.
I need one leader. You need a few followers.
Yes. Or having a good leader who actually takes the lead of the followers. There's a whole other discussion. That's all part of that communication.
Yeah.
So I was really happy to see that. But interestingly, and it goes back to your previous comment that you've just made, stress management. And I didn't expect that. Stress management was the second most, you know, skill that was thought or a trait that was required. And I think that's partly because there's this real fear about what the future is going to look like, the uncertainty. You know, going back to that very first question, will we have a regular job? Well, we may, but the majority of people will probably have several career moves throughout their lives. And so this ability to manage the stress of that is really important, but also the day-to-day stress. So I was happy to see it there, but I was also surprised. Some of the other areas, now these are the ones which we do know keep on showing up in all the literature. Complex problem solving, critical thinking, not quite the same thing, but creativity. And the last one was cognitive flexibility. When people ask me about cognitive flexibility, what do I mean? I usually say being able to say, yep, I'm wrong, and that's a good thing.
Yes.
Yeah, because that's learning.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Now I know something new.
There's another book in that one, Adam Grant's Think Again.
Oh, yes. Which is
very much around that notion of how do I, and which kind of comes into that critical thinking as well. How do I actually, and how do I learn? So, you know, do I need to rethink what I think I know or rethink my opinions on things and be open to other people's perspectives? His argument is that if we cultivate more of this across society, we might have few of some of the tumultuous political problems that we've had. And he's an American academic. So in that context in particular.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't think he's the first philosopher academic who's actually talked about this.
No, exactly.
But bringing the magnifying glass, when you look at all of these things about cognitive flexibility, problem solving, critical thinking, and we did purposely separate those things out because we wanted to see if there was a difference in how people were thinking about them. Based on our data, probably not. You could also sort of lump them to being being a flexible, open problem solver.
Mm. With good emotional regulation.
And then the other part is good emotional regulation. Thank you. That's a stress. I haven't heard that before. That's great.
Yeah, that's emotional so. I was just looking at that. I've written down that list as you've gone through, and we will put them in the show notes as well for people. But as you've gone through, you know, it's making my psychologist heart sing because I think this is what we know from a psychological point of view about what helps people to thrive as well. They're all the same sorts of skills. So being able to manage your emotions, regulate yourself, regulate your thoughts, regulate your mood, you know, you could tap into there some mindfulness type practice in there as well, just being able to be present in the moment to manage whatever's coming up for you. Acceptance and commitment therapy is probably part of that as well. You know, there's a whole lot of things that are kind of blossoming up in my mind as I look at that list to just to say, what are the really important things we need as human beings to thrive and therefore perhaps increasingly into the future?
So the little warning bell that goes off for me when I hear saying that, and by the way, I fully agree with that. And the research I did on education about the requirement to build mental health into the actual way that you teach mirrors that. But what do we do? The red flag that popped up for me is what do we do with neurodiversity?
Yeah.
Just for your listeners, I'm incredibly dyslexic, which is great for somebody who then, you know, proceeds to write a God knows how many hundred word thesis. And I write for a living in many ways. We are always drawn to that, which we hate. I don't know what it is yet. But also ADHD and all of these issues about neurodiversity are starting to crop up. In my field, in the technology field, autism is actually, in some ways, it can be a strength for certain types of autism, certain, you know, where you are on the spectrum. How do you fit that with this area of stress management and all these other things?
Well, again, putting my psychologist hat on, I think there's it's an appreciation of, and I think it's great there is so much conversation now and it will only increase in understanding the complexities of neurodiversity. And I would always argue that we're all neurodiverse. You know, there's no two brains that are the same. So, you know, you might have some that kind of collect with some similarities at different you know, parts of that spectrum, but none of us are the same. It would be terrible if we were, I think. So even just being able to think about how our brains work in that as a spectrum and that kind of diversity rather than lumping people together into kind of diagnostic categories would be my kind of personal way to do it if I got to, you know, as you've got a say in these things into the future.
And then that comes down to that communication effectively, knowing how to communicate.
Once you understand that and you are able to start tailoring, and, you know, it comes down to individual personal preference as to whether people want to identify as one of these neurodiverse categories per se. But I think if we generally all have a much greater open-mindedness to the fact that the way I communicate, the way I think, what interests me, my lens, the lens through which I see the world will not be the same as anybody else's, it opens up to curiosity and empathy and the opportunity to actually have a conversation with that person. You know, if you're thinking about it in a leadership space, if you know you've got five team members, the better you get to understand who they are at their core, what drives them, what motivates them, how their brain works, what lights them up, what frustrates them, then the better you are to be able to tailor your leadership style to that individual, no matter what that is.
Or your followership style.
Or your followership style, or for anything, or your parenting, or your
parenting
too. Across the board.
Yes, very, very true.
Across the board.
Yeah.
And that is part of critical thinking. You know, if you look at that list, that is part of critical thinking is understanding that. I think that stress management, that they all very much tie in together. But if we can be really open-minded about the fact that none of us are the same, it's a good starting point perhaps.
Great. So how do we make sure that our kids come out with those skills?
Exactly. How do we do that? Well, that's going to be my question to you then, Joe. I mean,
rats. Boomerang straight back. See, that's good communication right there. Take the question, throw it back.
Well, let's nut it out together perhaps, shall we? If you've got, so we're looking at, I'll just go through the list again just for listeners who perhaps don't have it in front of them like I do. So we had communicating effectively and all the different parts that fit into communicating. So it is that leading, following, connection.
Empathy.
Empathy, yeah. All of those fit into communication.
Another great book is on empathy, and I'll send you through the link on that one as well. So empathy can be taught.
Yeah, fantastic. So then stress management, or I would call it emotional regulation or just self-regulation, but again, that's stress management might be more meaningful to listeners. Complex problem solving, critical thinking, creativity, and by that, we're not just talking about the artistic realm, are we? Often we have to clarify, because I think
absolutely not.
The lay sense of creativity is the arts. In this sense, we're talking about the ability, and it probably overlaps with some of these other things, to think flexibly, to come up with new ideas, to innovate, and that as much applies to IT and science as it does to drama,
absolutely,
and
IT
arts.
And science. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I use it a lot.
Yeah. And then cognitive flexibility was the other one on the list.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
If you were a parent, Joe, again, of a small child, what would you be doing to help promote some of these sorts of skills?
I think the first thing is read some of Edward de Bono's early work and play some of the games. So Edward de Bono is a thinker. He's one of the founders of the notion of lateral thinking, which I think is the heart of creativity. One of the games that I used to play with my children was Poe, which is you take two random words from the dictionary and they have to join them together in some way. So brick and hat. So, you know, it's a hat made out of bricks. Well, let's think beyond that. How about we build a house in the shape of a Stetson so that we can have a skateboard park that runs around the outside of it? And then you just come up with a couple of random ideas like that, and then you vote on the favorite one. It's a great game to play in a car, better than I Spy. Mm. There's a whole bunch of other games. There was another game that we invented sort of following on called the collective noun game, which is where you have to say a word.
We love a collective noun at our house too.
Yeah, and then you all call out, you know, so it might be plumber, might be what you've got to create. The only rule is it's not allowed to be the real collective noun. So if it's plumber, it might be a leak of plumbers or a puddle of plumbers or a spurt of plumbers.
Yep.
And so, again, it's this idea of playing, that one specifically playing with language. Poe is really about invention. And the objective is not to have something realistic. The objective is just to free your mind up in multiple ways. Now, de Bono uses Poe, it was originally put forward, as a way of breaking. When you've got a problem in the workplace that you just can't figure out how to solve, you apply Poe to it. So there's another layer.
Mm, okay.
It's Poe stands for proposition. So, you know, you're building two things together. So I think that's a really good thing for creativity. In terms of problem solving, go back to that authentic learning. Have your children get involved in defining something they want to work on. And this can be at a very young age too. We want you to make some cookies. Right. What sort of cookies are we going to make? Are they going to have peanuts in them? Are they going to have, you know, whatever it is? Okay. If you add peanuts, how are you going to stop them from burning? These are the sort of questions that you can ask, maybe not year one, but certainly year three. Students can be involved in this. In terms of critical thinking, now critical thinking in this sense, probably for younger children, is a little bit difficult because critical thinking has a specific meaning around analyzing the situation of something, including who's included in that, who's excluded in that, and all that sort of stuff. We won't go into too much theory. But again, those Edward de Bono type games, asking your children, do they think that's fair, is another great way of promoting critical thinking.
I often ask, do you think that's true? And I've heard that.
I like that.
Yeah, I've heard that particularly around social media and the need for kids, as they're getting thrown so much information and the need to be able to critically assess what it is. I say social media, but in that including YouTube, I mean, anything
Everything.
That you're seeing on like the internet, I suppose you could probably say. And it applies to things they hear at school too. So-and-so said that his dad said that such and such. And so my response, which is, you know, really annoying when you're a kid, is, do you think that's true?
Could the question, okay, so.
Or do you think that's right?
I might actually change that question a bit. How do you know? That's true.
Yeah.
Because with critical thinking, I personally like to try when I'm working with younger students. And by younger, I don't mean, you know, I think the child needs to be sort of heading towards that year six, year seven and beyond age group. You want to get them to take away, this is this, you know, idea of cognitive flexibility coming into this discussion. Take the self away from thinking about things. Very, very hard to do, almost impossible to do. You know, we've got to be honest about that. I try and unbias everything I look at, but that requires a massive amount of self-reflection, which most children, sorry, younger children just not there. They don't even know.
There's a lot of adults that aren't there.
I'd argue that some of them never actually get beyond that, and that's okay as well.
Yep.
Interestingly, one of the other things about, if we go to an older age group, just jump ahead quickly, with the cognitive flexibility, I strongly recommend that you encourage your students to keep a handwritten diary of some form. It's an old craft. For me, being dyslexic, and by the way, I didn't know all of this when I was young. I wasn't diagnosed this way. But I started keeping a daily to-do list, including, when my classes were and so forth, and handwriting it. Even though I knew what was on, I'd handwrite it every day because it set my mind in that set. But then I'd do a reflection every day. And more recently, in the last decade or so, I started doing the idea of what am I thankful for? Gratitude statement. Not every day, sometimes only once a week. The handwriting aspect has a very specific cognitive benefit in education, but also the act of self-reflection, both positive and what did I learn today? How did today go? Has an incredibly strong ability to stimulate this idea of constant self-reflection, which is really, really healthy. Younger kids, no. late teenage kids, yes.
They're ready at that point. Yeah, that's a fascinating. Yeah. I mean, there's a huge amount of research done and certainly a lot of practice in psychology around journaling for all sorts of benefits. But I think just that self-reflection, being able to make sense of the muddle that's in your head sometimes and get it out on paper, whether that's just the, I'm so overwhelmed because there's so many things I feel like I need to do and I just need to write it down to kind of get it clear, through to I need to make sense of something complex or difficult or challenging that's happened in my life and try and, get some clarity on that.
Yeah, yeah. For me, it was a whole range of things. And incidentally, just for your listeners, I was recently diagnosed as probably being quite ADHD. Surprise!
Things make sense in your life?
It actually did once I started diving into what that meant. I went, oh, wow, I've self-discovered all of these techniques which are being recommended. One of them is, the journaling is part of that. So that, there are many, many benefits. We go back to that neurodiversity issue, but there are many benefits just for all people about self-reflection.
Absolutely. So there's some of the skills that we can all, as somebody who firmly believes that we never stop learning, growing and changing and developing, these are skills we can all consistently work on and then also be able to therefore both model and assist our children to work on, because they are the things we think we're going to need or they're going to need.
You're just actually prompting me to think something. When you work with your children on these games and on these little activities, you're also improving your ability to communicate. You're improving your creative thinking. You're improving your self-reflection. So it's a win-win situation here. Definitely.
Absolutely.
It'll make you better in your job right now for the future of work. But it's hugely important, I think, that if we want our kids to really thrive, no matter what job they're going to be and what work environment, that they have these skills.
And I think just to put a little mental health overlay on this as well, because it is such a topical topic, all of these things, again, looking at this list, everything from the communication, certainly the stress management, but even problem solving, critical thinking, that cognitive flexibility. I did a podcast interview, and I'll link to this in the show notes, I want to say probably about a year ago now, perhaps even a little over a year ago, regarding adaptability and how we adapt to new circumstances, which is part of this. So we adapt at a cognitive level, at an emotional level, and at a behavioral level. So what we think, how we feel and manage those feelings and what we do. And that is so much a critical part of mental health and well-being. Joe, such a fascinating conversation again today. We've still got, we're partway through these series of conversations. We've got so many more things to talk about. Today, just this notion of understanding what some of the skills are, the broader context of what the future of work looks like, that it's not just about the jobs and the technology, but it is about all of those socio-cultural, legislative, economic, other elements that we do have some control over now. So your point about parents, our listeners, thinking about, how much control they have, what they can do, get involved, help shape policy and legislation and decisions, lobby for the things that you think are important, and then this skill development piece around all of this cognitive flexibility and creativity and communication and stress management. And you have given us some great tips and tools and strategies to try that will help both our kids but also ourselves, importantly. And then we do have a little homework task. So last week, our listeners would have, hopefully, if they did their homework, and it's pretty easy homework to do, downloaded a little infographic that we had on the skills of the future, which is largely what we've spoken about today. We've got another one for you this week, and this week's one is on how we give our kids the edge for future workplaces, basically. So, and that'll kind of, you know, segue into next week's conversation is, and I'm going to throw to you, what is next week's conversation? What are we talking about?
Yeah, thank you. We're going to be talking about what are the type of jobs that will be in the future and what sort of skills, and also what jobs are likely to disappear. I think we're probably going to look more at, you know, what are the new opportunities out there? So we'll be looking at things such as, you know, how will artificial intelligence and automation and robots and all the rest of the things that go with that change some jobs? There are also some jobs that just won't go out of style. Which ones are going to be, if you will, the protected job? Now, bear in mind, I'm very cautious about those because we know from all the work I've done over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, even in those stable jobs, things change. Mm. Because new technology comes in there. So we're going to look at that. But most importantly, we're going to take a look at what would therefore be the types of things that you want your kids to learn. And that's going to differ by age group because the change that's coming up in 20 years' time will be a magnitude greater than the change in, say, 5 or 10 years' time. So some of these things have different imperatives. The good news is you have longer to prepare your child for that. So we'll look at some of those issues. I think it'll be a little bit controversial because some of the things I talk about with regards to AI will be quite different from some of the AI pundits you might get on the headlines.
Ooh, I love that.
And this is somebody who actually knows and has worked with AI in the past.
Fantastic.
And still plays with it.
Okay, very happy to be a little bit controversial and get people thinking. That's what we're all about.
Good.
Here. So thank you very much again, Joe, for a great conversation. For our listeners, all of the resources that we've mentioned, we did have a number of books and different things that list of skills we'll put. It's all in the show notes for today's conversation. And Joe, I look forward to getting into the nitty-gritty of our next, slightly more controversial conversations next week.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening into my second conversation in this podcast series with Doc Joe. There were a lot of great resources that came up in this conversation, including Bea Boccalandro's book, Too Good at Work, and Adam Grant's book, Think Again. And I'm sure I'm not the only one here who's a big Adam Grant fan. We've put links to these books and my podcast chat about job crafting with Cassandra Dunn, plus other great resources in the show notes for this episode, as we do for every episode. We also have free downloadable podcast summaries and tip sheets for each episode of this series. That's something new. And they're also in the show notes. So pop over and download your one pager giving you some summary of what Joe and I have discussed, but also our tips for helping our kids to thrive into the future. And keep an eye out on our socials this month, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook, as we're sharing snippets of the research that Joe and his team have done to support this podcast series. The fabulous Jay, who works for both Joe and I, has done an amazing job of putting all of these resources together for this series of the show, both the downloadable resources, the graphics explaining the research, and of course, our usual snippets from the interviews. And if you'd like to know more about Joe, we have a link to a Q&A in the show notes and our interactive show features if you're listening in on Spotify or Anchor, including our Q&A. And you can send me a voice message on Anchor. Maybe you have a question for me. Maybe you have a suggestion for a topic you'd like to see me cover on the show. Maybe you'd just like to say hi. Any of those is very, very welcome. So please pop on over to Anchor and send me a message. We'd also love it if you could rate and review the Potential Psychology podcast wherever you're listening. It is really helpful feedback. It does ensure that the word gets out about the show and we can share the amazing insights and wisdom of our very many guests that we've had. And finally, don't forget, you can now become a special VIP member of the Potential Psychology podcast community with access to our bonus episodes. To find out more, head over to our website, potential.com.au, or to anchor.fm/potential-psychology/subscribe. And next week, or next episode, in my next conversation with Joe, we're going to be exploring how much of an impact AI, so artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics, and automation will have on the future of work. I'm sure that's the question everyone's got in mind. It's really interesting stuff. So that is our next episode. It'll be with you very soon. But in the meantime, stay well, stay safe, and take small steps to fulfill your potential.